thank you very much for being here. I know what it, well, I don't know what it's like in Washington. I just assume it's a whole lot busier than being in Princeton. So I really appreciate the fact that you've come. The book that I'm going to say a few words about actually sort of has its origin in a course that Mike and I taught at Princeton back in 2002. And we gave it a name something like the historical roots of the Bin Laden phenomenon. Does that sound right? And we divided things up, and I was basically responsible for the heritage, and he was responsible for the current events. And at a certain point, I attempted to give a comparative lecture in which I ran the Islamists against the Hindu nationalists and the Latin American liberationists, you know, to see if I could come up with anything of interest or significance. And I would hate to think that any of the students who heard that lecture remembered any of it. I think I would find it extremely embarrassing if they did. But nevertheless, I got sufficiently interested in that comparative venture that I had one of those thoughts that academics often have, that, you know, this could be an interesting book. But I'm also, as well as being an academic, I'm a realist. And I therefore said to myself, but not in this life. But then something unexpected happened. I got that Mellon Award, and that freed up a lot of research time for me, unexpected research time. And that's how I came to be able to write that book in this life. And finally, there it is. Okay, in kind of introducing the book, I don't want to try and give you a summary of the outline, because I think that would be sort of kind of boring. What I want to do rather is pull out some bits of it and highlight them. And I'm going to start by going to the conclusion. I think it's the conclusion where I have a kind of anatomy of the Islamic revival and all that goes with it. And basically what I do there is to say that you can think of the Islamic revival as a kind of a pyramid. I mean, at the bottom of the pyramid, where it involves the largest number of people, and what you have is, by all accounts, a tremendous increase in piety and observance over the last few decades. Then in the middle of the pyramid, you have Islamist politics of one kind or another. And there's at least three major kinds, I would say. And there's Muslim identity politics, where what you're trying to do is to persuade Muslims to identify politically as Muslims. There's the politics of Islamic values, where what you're trying to do is to use the state apparatus, if you can get a hold of it, in order to establish some kind of moral policing. And thirdly, there's the politics of the Islamic State, which in its most obvious form seeks a restoration of the caliphate. And those are three very different political registers. And then finally, at the top of the pyramid, we have, of course, and this is where, relatively speaking, the smallest number of people are involved, we have the jihadis. So, I mean, that's the pyramid. And if you take that sort of rather crude pyramid, you know, one obvious question you might want to ask is this pyramid something distinctively, uniquely Islamic, or is it something that is par for the course all over the world in this day and age? And my answer to that is basically sort of in two parts. The first part says that each component of the pyramid, each element in the pyramid that I've identified, you can find a parallel to somewhere else. I mean, like, you know, this rise of piety and observance, well, that could easily remind you of the rise of Pentecostalism in Latin America. The sort of politics of Muslim identity, well, that could very easily remind you of the politics of Hindu identity in India. The politics of Islamic values, well, that certainly reminds me, coming from the old world, from Western Europe, of the Christian right in this country. There's the same aspiration to get a hold of the state apparatus. You do it a bit differently here than you may do it in the Middle East, but to get a hold of the state apparatus and use it to enforce Christian norms on a society that might not otherwise be very enthusiastic about them. And then finally, the politics of the Islamic State. Well, and what I mean by that is establishing a specifically Islamic state, a state that is, so to speak, Islamic from the ground up. Finding a parallel to that is not particularly easy, but I do have one. Namely, if we stay with the Christian right in this country and we go to the sort of far fringes of the Christian right, we have the Christian Reconstructionists, and they have very much a conception of what the Christian state has to look like, how it would be built. And then finally, with jihadis, and what I'm thinking about when I talk about jihadis, it's not simply the fact that they're violent interests me. It's the fact that the violence, and it's not simply the fact that the violence is on behalf of a religion, pursuing the interests of a religious community, and it's the fact that it's the enactment of a religious duty. If you're looking for a parallel to that in the modern world, I guess, one we can quite easily find is the militancy of the Sikhs in India. Not right now, but a generation ago, it was very pronounced, and it has been pronounced also in the past. So, I mean, every single component of this pyramid, you can parallel somewhere else. But on the other hand, if you want the pyramid as a whole, that, as far as I can see, is unique in the world today. I mean, I really had to run around the globe pulling those parallels together. And I think the situation I've described fits fairly well with certainly my intuitive sense of the present state of the world with regard to religion and politics. That is to say that you have a spectrum, and at one end of the spectrum, you've got Western Europe, which is where religion has as little to do with politics as it does anywhere. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have the Islamic world, and the rest of the world, by and large, is somewhere in between. And so my real question then is, why should the Islamic world be the outlier in this respect? And what I want to suggest, what I argue in the book, well, first of all, the obvious common sense assumption would be that this, if there is something distinctive about the Islamic world, it must have something to do with Islam. That's not necessarily true, but it's an obvious assumption. But the question then is, just what does it have to do with Islam? And the fundamental argument that I'm pushing in the book, it's really a very simple one. It's that if you take the Islamic heritage, it has more resources for people who are active in modern politics, in the politics of the modern world, than other heritages do. I mean, you're simply getting a better bouquet of resources in the Islamic case than you're getting, say, in the Hindu case, or you're getting, say, in the Catholic case in Latin America. And what I want to do now is just to pull out a couple of examples of this so that you get a sense of, what I'm driving at. And let me start with identity politics. And let's start with identity politics in the Hindu nationalist style. And as I'm sure you know, the Hindu nationalist project is to get all Hindus to identify politically as Hindus and, not least, to vote accordingly for the BJP. And there are two basic problems with this project. Well, one of them maybe is, they're both basic. The first problem is that the Hindu heritage has no conception of a Hindu identity. There is no conception of a Hindu identity that you can pull out, that you can invoke, that you can use in Hindu nationalist politics. In fact, I mean, the very word Hindu is a loan word in India. They got it from Iran, or it was brought to them by the Muslims from Iran. What they do have is what the heritage does have is a conception of Aryan identity. But unfortunately, Aryan identity extends only to the twice born, who are obviously a minority in the Indian context. It excludes the bulk of the population. So that's not really a very good start. And then the other problem, or the other sort of set of problems, has to do with the Indian caste system. And I'm not sure, I certainly don't fully understand this, but I mean, basically, what it comes down to is that the castes in the middle of Hindu society are just not particularly interested in identifying politically as Hindu. They have other agendas. And the castes down at the bottom are somewhat reluctant to identify as Hindu at all. Now, of course, this may sound like an odd thing for me to be saying in the days after an election where, for the first time, the BJP has secured a majority in the Indian Parliament. But I mean, what I would want to say about that is that what we've just seen is not a testimony to the success of Hindu nationalist identity politics. It's a testimony to the success of Mr. Modi's appeal to free market economics. Now, free market economics has no intrinsic connection to Hindu nationalism. It's not, I mean, back, say, in the early 1970s, the Hindu nationalists were kind of socialists. I mean, you know, basically their evolution in terms of economic thought is completely opportunistic. It's not part of their core message at all. And yet that is what has got them this extraordinary position of actually having a majority in the Indian Parliament. Okay, so that's one example. And then I'll just give you one more example. And here I'm taking the polity. And again, I'll make it a sort of Hindu-Islamic comparison. Whereas the Hindu heritage has basically nothing to say about Hindu identity, it has a lot to say about the Hindu polity. The trouble is, it's all about Hindu monarchy. And it's about Hindu monarchy in a style that simply doesn't resonate with modern values in the world today. And the result of that is that the Hindu nationalists simply don't appeal to that part of the Hindu heritage. They're not interested in what the Hindu heritage has to say about the polity. Instead, they're entirely comfortable with the Indian Republic that we have at the present day as a result of mid-20th century events. All they want to do is to inject a stiff dose of Hindu identity into that republic. But the republic itself, they have no problem with. And there's nothing they can do with the Hindu heritage in that context. By contrast, if we go to the Islamic case, well, there, of course, we're talking about, so if you really want to push it, we're talking about restoration of the caliphate, and that may sound like a kind of archaic and irrelevant idea in the early 21st century. But do note two things about the idea of the caliphate. First of all, you know, since the caliphate is in principle a state that includes the entire Muslim community, it speaks to a sense of geopolitical disadvantage, which is very contemporary. It has a very strong geopolitical resonance that is not particularly in the least medieval. Secondly, and this is maybe more important, the caliphate, not the caliphate down the centuries, but the early caliphate, the caliphate of the first decades after the life of the Prophet, is associated in the early sources with what you might call some proto-republican values. Let's say you go back to the early caliphate, you will not find democracy, or you have to work very hard to pretend that there's democracy there. But what you will find is a very vivid rejection of despotism and patrimonialism. And that, of course, resonates tremendously well with modern political values. And not surprisingly, Islamists are appealing to that all the time. I mean, if you take when President Morsi was installed as president of Egypt, he made a speech in which he virtually quoted what the Caliph Abu Bakr had said when he became Caliph in 632, which was all about, if I do right, sort of encourage me, and if I do wrong, then make sure you correct me. Okay. In conclusion, let me just say a word about what I'm not saying. One thing that I'm not saying is that simply being a believing Muslim does not constrain you to adopt a certain kind of politics. It doesn't constrain you to construct your politics out of your religion. Some Muslims do that, some Muslims don't. You know, if you look at, say, the political history of the Middle East in the 20th century, you will see a lot of politics going on, which in inspiration is just like politics elsewhere in the world. It's liberal, or it's fascist, or it's leftist, and above all, it's nationalist, all very familiar categories from elsewhere in the world. It's just that in addition, we have this Islamist politics. But there's nothing that constrains Muslims to go one way or the other. And then the other thing I want to say here about what I'm not saying, if you're a believing Muslim and you have decided to construe your politics out of your religious heritage, that doesn't in itself determine the character of your politics. I mean, this is a very familiar point, but Islamist politics comes to us in very different flavors at the present day. It goes all the way from the, so to speak, ex-Muslim brothers, the very moderate ex-Muslim brothers, very democratic in Egypt, who have not been particularly successful. But I mean, the people who broke off from the main movement a few years ago, goes all the way from that to Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. So I'm not arguing for any kind, for, so to speak, the heritage constraining the kind of politics that people adopt. What I am saying, and this is the basic message of the book, is that you get a set of resources in this heritage that you can, if that's what you want to do, use quite effectively in politics in the modern world. I think that's probably plenty from me at this point.
Well, thanks for that. What an honor and a pleasure it is. It took me back actually to 2002 when we did that course. Let me just take up where you left off here and just talk a little bit more about what you're saying and what you're not saying, and let's map you in the crude politics of our contemporary debate. So on one end we have the kind of people that make it embarrassing for me to be a Republican, who say that we have this conspiracy, the Sharia conspiracy against America, and that basically Bin Laden is the truest representative of this of the Islamic heritage. And then on the other hand, we have the postmodernists in the academy, who say there's no such thing as tradition, right? Everybody can make whatever they want. We all sort of recreate ourselves, I don't know, from moment to moment. I don't exactly understand how they think, but anyway, that's completely unacceptable. And you're somewhere in the middle here,
yep. Yeah?
And perhaps you could just talk a little bit more. You basically just said it, though, about the resources, but a little bit more about how you think about these things. Obviously, obviously heritage does matter to a certain extent, you're saying.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think, you know, we're all the time in real life or in whatever studies and research we do, we're talking about situations where an idea comes into a context. And in common sense terms, I think we all recognize that the contexts are important and the ideas are important, you know, for what comes out of that, for the outcome. And obviously, you know, differences in context make a lot of difference to the outcome. Differences in the ideas make a lot of differences. Well, make a difference for the outcome. Now, I mean, it seems to me that most people in the academy are very comfortable talking about the variation in context, but not very comfortable talking about the variation in the ideas. And this suits me just fine, because it means that, I mean, it seems to me that, you know, that the ideas matter is common sense, so to speak.
Right.
I wouldn't know how to defend it philosophically, but it is common sense.
Right.
And the fact that people are a little sort of scared of it means that there's a nice space that I've been able to fill, which otherwise, you know, I mean, simply bringing common sense to bear on something doesn't usually get you any very sort of striking rewards, yes? But I think in this case, there's more mileage I can get out of applying common sense than is usually the case.
Actually, I think it wasn't Mark Twain who said the amazing thing about common sense is it's not very common. If I was to make the postmodern argument, which I don't usually make, but let me just take a stab at it and see how you'd respond. And I would say, well, okay, you in your book, you use the metaphor of the menu. The tradition offers people in the modern era a menu, and they can pick different items. So there's an element of choice involved, and obviously too, the tradition changes. Nobody today, or aside from a few in Bureda, believing Muslims today, for the most part, don't think that their religion allows them to have slaves. Right, so they dropped at some point that part,
and Boko Haram, of course.
Yes. And so they do exist, but for the majority of people, that bit of the tradition fell by the wayside. So so how is it then that these things, obviously there is some kind of way in which they get shaped and reshaped, both by over time, historical change over time, and choices that people make in the modern era. So how would you respond to that if I tried to put I haven't done the greatest job, but said I think you've overweighted the importance of ideas in this mix.
Right. I think I would probably make a number of points there. There's a point that was just in my head and I wanted to make it and now it's gone out.
You were going to say, Duran, you just bested me.
No, I do not want to say that.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, here's one thing I wanted to say, which is that there is, how can I put it? Yes, traditions do change, but there's very considerable inertia there. They don't change at the flick of a wrist. They change slowly with pushing and shoving. A change that may seem completely legitimate in 20 years may not seem in the least legitimate in just 2 or 3 years. I think that the people that you are trying to simulate greatly exaggerate the plasticity of traditions. It's like there's somebody I quote, I think, in my preface about identities, when he says they are elastic, but they're not sort of infinitely elastic. I forget the exact words. And I think the same thing applies with traditions. I mean, you know, you pull at an elastic band, and it pulls back.
Right.
And if you snap it, that's not good. Right. So that, I think, is one important part of it. it's the other part that I'm saying. Yeah, ask me something else, and it'll occur to me.
So,
I'll come
so
back
let
to
me it. Let me just ask you to, if you could just run through for the audience, in just almost listing them off, those elements that you believe, those resources that the tradition does offer somebody who has a fundamentalist inclination. Actually, now that I've said that, why don't I ask you, first of all, to you go into great detail in the book defining fundamentalist,
yep,
so that you can do the
yes,
comparison across mm-hmm traditions. Perhaps you should just quickly talk about your upstream downstream concept of fundamentalism, and then so we have a baseline for the whole discussion, and then I'll ask you my next question.
Right. Okay. And what I'm basically saying there is, I mean, fundamentalism is a term that's kind of up for grabs, and you know, different people sort of push it and pull it in different directions. And sort of one major thing that people try to do is to, as it were, produce a sort of elaborate identikit version of fundamentalism. And that seems to me to be a mistake. It's not a mistake that I particularly object to, but it's not one that I'm going to adopt myself. So, and what I use the term for is just one particular feature of a religious attitude, which is wanting to go back to the original form of your religion and being kind of serious about it. And what I'm doing there then is contrasting my three traditions in terms of what happens if you try to do that, what works for you and what doesn't work for you. You know, so that basically in the Hindu case, it doesn't work at all. In the Catholic case, it works in one respect for the liberationists, but not in most others. Whereas in the Islamic context, I think it works in several respects.
Right. And so then my question...
That links to the question.
Right, that's yes, my question then. So if you've got that inclination, if you have that mindset...
Yes.
And you're working within the Islamic tradition. What are those elements that the tradition offers you?
Right, and I think you know, the first one is this very clear-cut conception that being a Muslim is a political identity. I mean, it's not something that all Muslims have had down the centuries, but it's something that you can access very easily if you go back to the beginnings, you know, to the sort of earliest form of the tradition that we have. Secondly, I would say in terms of social values, something that has been very important for Islamist politics in the modern world is egalitarianism.
Mm.
Now, of course, I mean, it's not, it's an egalitarianism for free male Muslims. It's not quite sort of a Western egalitarianism. It's a long way from a Western egalitarianism. But, I mean, it is a genuine egalitarianism. And as such, it resonates very strongly with modern values, and I think that makes it a very attractive feature of the heritage, mm-hmm, and it gets trotted out repeatedly. I would say then the political values that I referred to as sort of proto-republican, again, I think are pretty important here. That's what enables you to, I mean, one, to reject centuries of, you know, to use a political, an old-fashioned term, Oriental despotism, or despotism in the Islamic world, but also to, in a sense, have some key Western values without having to acknowledge having gotten them from the West. I think those would be the three biggest things that I would put there.
It was striking to me that you didn't compare Judaism.
Yes.
And you have a good explanation as to why you didn't, but it was one that I wanted,
yes,
as a reader. And so I wonder if I could put you on the spot and and ask you off the top of your head to give us the comparison. I mean, that's the one that seems to me to be the most similar to the Islamic tradition. And so how would you compare and contrast those in terms of the resources,
right,
that Judaism hands someone who,
yes,
would want to have who would want to fundamentalize their identity?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, let's take it first in terms of fundamentalizing. Judaism is a bit awkward in that respect. I mean, if you want to produce a Protestant form of Judaism, what you've produced is Karaism, which is that early medieval heresy, which rejected the rabbinic tradition and said, we got the Bible, that's it. And I mean, there have been people, I can think of at least one early Zionist, Lilian Bloom, reinvented Karaism for himself in Odessa, I think, sort of on the way to the land.
You're stuck with the rabbis, in other words.
Right. I mean, if you're going to reject the rabbis, you're really breaking with Judaism as we know it. And if you're going to sort of stay with the rabbis, you can't do that kind of fundamentalism.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, since we have a very sort of powerful sort of clerical establishment in Israel, I mean, they're not even going to let you say, I'm rejecting all the later rabbis and going back to the Mishnah or something like that, you know. So Judaism is a very tough nut to crack if you want to produce a fundamentalism in my sense. Now, if what you want to produce is a kind of, you know, pretty muscular religion, I guess, right, let's think. This is where I found the secondary literature in English just not particularly helpful. But I mean, if we go back to my pyramid and we pull out the moral policing, there's a very obvious parallel to that in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole scene of Haredi sort of extremists who seek to impose their conception of Jewish values on others. That's definitely there. Identity politics. Well, I mean, the whole Zionist movement is a piece of identity politics. Something I heard recently is that if you looked at the books on Muhammad Ali Jinnah's bookshelf, books about the Jewish question bulked very large indeed.
Right.
And I think it's not accidental. And he was an intelligent and insightful man, and he knew what he was thinking about there, even if he didn't talk about it much. Which is that, with both the Zionists and the sort of Pakistan movement, what you've got is basically a bunch of people who are very much aware of being Muslims, but have very little commitment to Muslim beliefs or sort of observances. And it's the same in the sort of classic Zionist case. You're very committed to being Jewish, but you basically don't care about anything the rabbis care about. You know, so I think there's a real sort of analogy there.
I can't remember the context, but there in some reading about some early Zionists who had a parade to the Western Wall, and at the end of the parade they ate ham sandwiches.
There we are. Yes.
Yeah. Just if I could follow up on the Jewish question. So we've got, we lose the, Islam and politics are tied together from the beginning, or in the golden age. And it gets complicated with the Jews because they lose their state and the rabbis are, this is my interpretation of history. Mm-hmm. You can take issue with it if it's too crude. The rabbis take over for the state. But now we've got a state. And we also have a group of people who are religious and supportive of the state, right? So not the muscular religious Haredi types, but the national religious settler types. Mm-hmm. So what about them? If we just were to analyze them with your framework, the Hilltop Youth, the Price Tag Movement, and so on, are they? What kind of resources does the tradition give them?
Right.
In this context.
And what resources does it not give them? And I think let me start with what it doesn't give them. I think that it doesn't really give them any conception of what an intrinsically Jewish state should look like. That's to say, you know, you go over the heritage, you know, you have Moses, you have the, that's one model, if you like, you have the judges, that's another model, you have the monarchy, that's another model. I mean, there's simply, you know, whereas in the Islamic case, yeah, and let's say we're among Sunnis, and you ask what would an intrinsically Islamic state be, the caliphate is a straightforward answer. I don't see that there's a straightforward answer in the Jewish case, partly because of all these different memories,
right,
but also because, as you say, they lost their state, and having lost it, they adapted to having lost their state. So there's sort of the baggage of having spent millennia as a diaspora also there. So really, I would say it's quite a mess.
Yeah.
It's not obvious what you, you know, what you pull out of that and say, this is what the Jewish state should be.
One of the things that I most I found very enlightening about your argument was at the end when you ran through, you talked about conservative politics, conservative, modernist, and fundamentalist. And you talked about the resonance, sort of the echo of Islamic fundamentalism with the modernist, with modernism, mm-hmm, and with conservatives.
Yes.
Conservatives. That's really striking, I think, because I don't know that that's the case in any of the, or I don't think it is in any case that I can think of. It's basically what you said about the pyramid. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, and if we were to take the Hindu case, conservatism, religious conservatism in the Hindu context means keeping things as they have been in recent centuries. And just about everything about Hinduism in recent centuries disappears if you insist on being a fundamentalist and throwing out everything since the Vedas. It's not like that in the Islamic case, and there's a much tighter relationship there, I think.
I think the most surprising one, though, is where you say that it resonates with modern, that fundamentalism and modernism kind of are not as antagonistic as one might have expected.
Right, and there is something I think very interesting here that I don't think I fully understand, but it I'm sure it has something to do with Islam taking shape in a tribal environment against the background of tribal politics. Because, I mean, tribal politics are very different from what we have at the present day. But there are some common features, namely this sort of high valuation of independence, you know, the sort of strongly anti-despotic sentiment, you know, the old tribal rejection of kingship, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. You know, there is a kind of resonance there.
Plus the egalitarianism there.
Yes, exactly.
So can I ask you to make another comparison that you didn't make? You show how the Catholic heritage can contort itself and give you liberation theology, but it's really a contortion. And you didn't really go deeply into the American Protestant case, which gave us the term fundamentalist. Yes. So why do we have such a powerful, especially, you know, when you compare it to Europe, why is it so powerful here in the United States, and what resources are they drawing from?
Yes, and there I really ought to have brushed up on my American history, or rather more than brushed up, I'm afraid to say. But I guess that this has quite a lot to do with the fact that, what was it, and there was a well-known historian of sort of colonial America at Harvard a generation or two ago, who wrote a book called Errand in the Wilderness. And I think, I mean, that kind of gets the way in which a crucial element in the formation of this country was people who were religiously very zealous and who wanted to take their zeal somewhere where they could act it out, with less sort of obstruction than they could back home in the old world. And that surely has given this country a different religious profile from what we have in Europe. But as regards in some ways I find it very hard to see just why the Christian heritage gives so much encouragement to the fundamentalists in this country. In that, from their point of view, family values are absolutely the bedrock, aren't they? And, you read the Gospels, and family values are definitely getting a knock. You're being told to follow Jesus and hate your father and mother and that kind of thing. there's a real sort of mismatch there.
Well, it is a menu, as you say, right?
Yes. if I was to try to understand fundamentalists in this country better, I would try and home in on that and see if I could sort of get my mind around what's happening there. But it's also surely got... I think that's about as much as I can give you at this point.
Well, I thought you were going to say that, like with Judaism, there's no, what a Christian state looks like is a real problem, right? You're not going to
exactly.
You can do the values politics, but when it comes out of having a picture of what the polity should be, it sort of falls apart.
Yeah, thank you for that prompt. Yes, yes, right, and that's where, and one of the things that really strikes me is the absence of the Christian right, as far as I can see, almost all of it is perfectly comfortable with the existing republic. It simply wants to get different political outcomes out of the existing republic. And overwhelmingly, they're on board with the American Constitution. They will say that the American Constitution is much misunderstood and it's not really a secular document, really. It's a Christian document. But, they're not breaking with it.
Right.
And it's only those Christian reconstructionists that I mentioned who have...
Who are way on the fringe.
And they're way on the fringe. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
All right, that's great. Why don't we open it up now to the crowd, and there's Bridge.
Thank you, Professor Cook. Fascinating, and I took... I'm going to take my good friend Will's admonition to be a little controversial and make a couple comments and then a question. On this point, a couple of things. First, I apologize, I haven't read your book, but I'm looking forward to it. I will buy it. Your definition of fundamentalist describes to me simply any religious revival. Under the definition as you at least described it here, which is to say an attempt to recapture the past or return to some kind of purity of the original, religious phenomenon, that would describe Martin Luther, that would describe the Ressourcement movement that produced John Paul II and Benedict XVI in the Catholic Church, that describes any attempt to return, particularly for religions that do depend on this crucial initiating figure, like obviously Jesus Christ or Muhammad. So, to me, the question is, that's an invariable part of any religious revival, reintensification of a religious phenomenon. The question is, how is that manifested? And Luther takes it in one direction, and the liberation theologians are emphasizing the common ownership of goods. I think that the story of even though Benedict XVI and John Paul II were considered conservatives in the context where they were younger, they were actually quite reformists because they were actually trying to get past the encrustation, the scholasticism, and so forth. So I just think that definition of fundamentalism is a little bit, it doesn't strike me as ringing very true. And on the point about the fundamentalists here, I agree with your point, except that the problem in your analysis is that New England was the place of religious fanaticism early on, but fundamentalism, as we know it, exists in the South and the West. And I think there's a disconnect there, because actually the most secular and European-like parts of the country are actually the ones that were settled by the religious fanatics at the time. And so to me, something has to do with also the absence of a state church is a big part, so that people could try it out. And obviously U.S. history is sort of undulation. So forgive me for going on for a little bit, but those are just a couple of comments. I'm interested in, as I said, I mean, the joke is the Bible says a lot of things, right? That Jesus, on the question of Christianity going back and its political coloration, there it seems to me, and Will and I have talked about this a lot over the years, that there is a sort of content. I mean, I would obviously, I think most of us are in that, somewhere in the middle of that space. But to me, I tend to emphasize against the postmodernists that there is a sort of reality. And, Jesus Christ as a figure is, for instance, somebody who doesn't attempt to establish a political institution. He says, render under Caesar that which is Caesar. And I know relatively little about Islam, but one of the things that I find interesting in discussing with various people over the years is, for instance, this, well, Islam needs a reformation. Islam needs a, it needs what Christianity went through. And I always recoil at that because it seems to me to be very relativistic that Islam's, essential message is some different content. And I'd just be interested in your comments. Sorry, it's a long-winded question. But your comments on how does somebody, what is there genuine good faith space, and I think you were suggesting it, but is there genuine good faith space where somebody who is a very committed Muslim can go back and say and attempt to reconcile a genuine faith with what we understand to be modernity and political modernity broadly construed? Obviously there are things that are not going to be compatible, but if you look, Islam does appear to have a much stronger political coloration. Muhammad behaves in certain ways that are very politically, sets up a political establishment. How is that going to turn out, and how would somebody wrestle with that?
Right. Okay, let me start then by going back to what you said about the disconnect between the Northeast in this country and the Bible Belt. Yeah, that's certainly the case, and surely what that has a lot to do with is that this kind of American fundamentalism doesn't work well in big cosmopolitan cities. There's something about the sort of the relative isolation of that environment down there that is much more sort of favorable to it. I don't think there's anything more that I could usefully say about that. I'm trying to read my own writing. Yeah. Okay, I would see a difference between my definition of fundamentalism and where you went with it. In that, it seems to me that where you went with it is by lumping together what I would call fundamentalists with conservatives. And, and from the point of view of, your sort of committed secular liberal, they may be very similar species. But, they're at least conceptually different, and they may in practice be very different. Mike mentioned my kind of upstream-downstream thing. When I talk about fundamentalism, I really want to refer to people who want to go back to the beginning and take it from there and disallow, just about everything that's happened since, which is very different from conservatism, which says, the way it came down to my dad was just right, and I want to keep it that way or get it back to that, to being that way. And it seems to me that Martin Luther American fundamentalism, these are very good examples of fundamentalism in my sense. And what you do is you go back to the New Testament. Whereas by contrast, when we're talking about recent popes, they definitely did not want to go back to the New Testament and just the New Testament and throw out the entire development of ecclesiastical authority since then. They are, in my terminology, conservatives and not fundamentalists. Good faith space. I think, one, in terms of what's actually sort of in the heritage, there are certainly things that you can comfortably latch onto for that kind of effort that you described. And people do latch onto them, and they will latch onto them. I think in practice, a lot is going to depend on the more general atmosphere. I mean, this is one of the, I don't think what I've said about heritage determines things. Let me sort of repeat that here. I mean, at present, we have a situation. Yeah, there's an interesting article that was written by, can I remember his name? He's a philosopher of South Asian background at, I think, Columbia. And he wrote a piece about Muslim identity in which, now this is sort of my spin on it, but to my mind, what it amounted to is something like this, that in the old days when we were leftists, we could be very dismissive about the contents of the heritage without feeling that we were kowtowing to the West. But that since the demise of leftism, this is no longer the case. That is to say, for a Muslim to be very dismissive of the contents of the heritage gets perilously close to being a kind of cultural traitor or something like that. And that very definitely was not the case in the old days when leftism was very strong. And I think how those kind of pressures develop, which are not something, you know, that my book is about, is going to be pretty important in the answer to your question.
Helen.
Thank you. First of all, my name is Khaled, and I'm a fellow at the Savant Center here. And I haven't read your book either, but I look forward to it as well. I was wondering if you could clarify, just so that I understand what, I guess, your central thesis is, if you could maybe sort of restate it. The way I recall it is you had said that there's a clear-cut sense that being Muslim was inherently political. I forget the exact language, but something essentially political which distinguishes it from the other religious traditions. Before that, you make clear that among the things that you're not saying is that being a believing Muslim necessarily, I suppose, constrains or predetermines the political, I forget again your exact words, but essentially doesn't make one necessarily constrained to Islamize politics, per se. So I'm trying to reconcile those two. And maybe if you could just maybe unpack that statement on the clear sense that being Muslim was, obviously you know your own thoughts better than I, but if you could restate it and sort of unpack it for us, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Right. It's really, and I think the distinction I want to make here is about what I'm talking about. First, if we take the values that you can find enshrined in the heritage, you know, the values that if you're of a sort of fundamentalist disposition, you will particularly focus on, then I think there's not the slightest question that being a Muslim is a political identity. I mean, it's being a member. I mean, once the Prophet leaves Mecca and goes to Medina, if you're a Muslim, you're a member of a political community in Medina. And it's then an expanding political community that becomes an empire. So I think, I mean, as a fact about the values in the heritage, I think what I said is straightforwardly right. But the other question you could be asking is, if we take the average Muslim, or the average Muslim in any century, or Muslims up and down the centuries, is Islam a political identity for them? That's a different question. And it's a question which would not be answered by looking at the heritage in the way I've done. It's a question that you would answer, if you could answer it at all, in modern times by public opinion, contemporary terms, by public opinion surveys, in terms of the past, by squeezing historical sources for what you can find. And I mean, I think what I would tend to say there is that, as an empirical matter, it is quite easy for Muslim identity to be politicized in the modern world. We've seen it done quite a few times. And this no doubt has something to do with, what I'm not saying is that we're starting with Muslims with a politicized identity. What I'm saying is it is politicizable under modern conditions, and that this politicizability has something, not everything, to do with the fact that the value is there in the heritage. But I mean, let me say something sort of, by way of pouring a certain amount of cold water here. There's a guy who's written on Islamism in Morocco who makes what to my mind is a very nice point. He says that Islamists go on and on about how Islam and politics are joined at the hip. They don't go on and on about how heaven is a reality and Muhammad was a prophet. In other words, they don't have to go on and on about Muhammad being a prophet and the reality of heaven, because those are things that people genuinely take for granted. Whereas obviously a lot of people out there that these Islamists are talking to don't take it for granted that Islam and politics are joined at the hip. If they did, the Islamists wouldn't have to keep talking about it all the time. And I think that's a very real point. Hmm.
Thank you very much. So if there are more resources in the Islamic heritage to Muslims to find, I guess, a political outlet definitions, does that mean that there's also more resources for Muslims to expand the notion of Muslim identity politics? I mean, does it cut both ways? I mean, I think, because if you look at it on one hand, you would say, wow, so there's a good chance that we could see a caliphate, that they have more resources to be able to justify the caliphate or the totally Islamic political system, then you could bring that to its conclusion and say that, well, then there's a kind of a good chance that we may see a caliphate here or there. But you could also say that there would be more ways to define a Muslim political system.
More ways to define?
A Muslim political system to expand it beyond just the notion of a caliphate. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Right, and I think there's a difference there between, and if you take the set of people who are really serious about restoring the caliphate, I think that is a significantly smaller set of people than the set of people who want to make the values of the early Islamic, to recover the values of the early Islamic polity, but not necessarily within the framework, the institutional framework of the caliphate. So that, I mean, if you like, there's, so to speak, a strong version and a weaker version. And, I mean, it's perfectly possible for, the argument for the weaker version would be, if nothing else, this caliphate may be a very evocative idea, but it's totally unrealistic. In terms of the geopolitics of the world as it is, it's not going to happen. And, if you read Zawahiri's account of how he wants it to happen, it's really a very, very long shot there. So that, for many the Muslim brothers in Egypt were not talking about restoring the caliphate. But nevertheless, they were talking about these, what I call, proto-republican values. So I think, there's a distinction there. And some people will pursue the sort of the full version, and some people will pursue a not so full version, and maybe get further with it.
Nathan.
Hi, I'm Nathan Sachs from Brookings as well. I work on Israel. A comment and a question. On the Jewish fundamentalists, I think there's an interesting distinction between what Michael's raising, which is religious nationalists, many of whom are messianic or have a messianic version of Zionism. I don't mean the messianic pejoratively necessarily, but rather a vision of a divine future that is tied to Zionism. And these new hilltop youths who are, in a sense, revolting against their rabbis, not just against the ultra-Orthodox rabbis, but against the modern Orthodox rabbis. And there is fundamentalism. There they suddenly talk about the Temple Mount and going up there to pray because they want to go back to the Old Testament the way it was. It's very, and much less emphasis on the Talmud, much less emphasis on Zionism, certainly on the state of Israel that has betrayed them, but rather going back to the roots of the Old Testament and reconstituting something there, which the rabbis don't even know what that is. But in that context, I want to ask a question more broadly about your choice of fundamentalism as the core. Why should we care politically, analytically is fascinating, but why should we care politically to distinguish between fundamentalism that is necessarily going back to an invented past versus messianism of various kinds that are just going towards an invented future? In a sense, why should we care about the Sunni fundamentalists but distinguish them completely from Shia, I don't know what the word to use, but sort of Shiism, extreme Shiism, that looks not, I suppose, necessarily to the past, but maybe to a future exponential Shiism. And in this case, Jewish messianism that is not fundamentalist would still be very interesting in the political context. Catholic, maybe not, perhaps, but the Protestant can follow. In other words, from a phenomenon point of view, why is messianism so different from fundamentalism?
Can I just restate his question, and or ask another one that is related? I don't know if I'm asking the same question, so it may be a restatement of it, but you can either answer both of them if it's a different statement. But if I put it in the most provocative, antagonistic way, aren't you guilty of having created the definition of fundamentalism that privileges your argument? So you've sort of defined fundamentalism as we find it among the Muslims, and then therefore we don't find it elsewhere. Whereas we could find these other forms that would, like messianism, that would fit the bill.
Right.
Is that it? Okay. So same question.
Okay, let me sort of start from you and then sort of move to you. Right. One thing is, I'm actually very tepid in talking about Muslim fundamentalism in the book. In that what I say is, I mean, having defined it my way, I don't then say, and these Islamists are obviously 100% fundamentalists. I say simply that there is a kind of fundamentalist streak or strain in them. But I mean, they don't strike me as out-and-out fundamentalists. And I think from that point of view, you know, the term is definitely misleading. I mean, for example, the Hindu fundamentalist I talk about, Dayanand, and he may be an imperfect fundamentalist, but I think he's a more solid case of a fundamentalist in my sense than, say, Maududi or Sayyid Qutb. I'm not defining it in order to pin it on the Muslims, so to speak.
Right, right.
I'm defining it simply in order to detect something that's a strain among the Muslims. Now, but with regard to messianism, it seems to me that there's I mean, it's an interesting fact about modern Islamic politics, both Sunni and Shiite, that they're not messianic in any sort of technical sense. I mean, there isn't a messiah figure there. The Sunnis have their Mahdi. He's there in the heritage, not in the Quran, but he's sort of elsewhere in it. But, the Islamists of our times are not interested in the Mahdi, and they don't, as far as I know, talk about him. In the same way with the Shiites, I mean, they have their 12th Imam, who is to return as the Mahdi. And yeah, sure, there are a few crazy people in Iran who think that might happen sometime soon. But I mean, the whole Islamic Republic is not constructed on the premise that the Mahdi is about to arrive. It's constructed on the premise that we're doing something in the meantime, right? Yeah. And it seems to me that this is not trivial in the sense that there's an inherent instability about Mahdism or messianism. That's to say that if you pin your hopes on a figure who is to come and who is to be sort of, I won't say supernatural, but a sort of completely discontinuous from previous history, you then get into a bit of a bind, because either you have to keep explaining the fact that he hasn't arrived, or you have to identify somebody as the Messiah and then he turns out to be a flop. I mean, there's a sort of instability there which we don't have on the Muslim side. And I would tend to suspect that one of the reasons why this messianism has become prominent in the Jewish case, I mean, sort of people like my namesake, Rav Kook, and so, is precisely that short of the coming of the Messiah, there isn't a clear-cut conception of what the Jewish state should be in the heritage. The Messiah comes, then it's all going to be plain, no problem. But it's a very risky sort of advent to bet on. And I think the Islamists are quite sensible in not having gone that way.
I'm Rafi Danziger. I'm now a consultant way back, but too many decades ago, I was a fellow Princetonian with Carl Brown being my wonderful advisor. And I haven't had the privilege of reading your book yet either, and I will. But we'll probably discuss it at some length. But it seems that one of the obvious differences between, on one hand, Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam and Christianity is that in Christianity, of course, the cross, the martyrdom of Christ, is still the symbol. In Shia, it's the Hussein, the martyrdom of Hussein. But in Sunni Islam, it's Muhammad the Conqueror and his successor, the Caliph Conquerors. And to this day, of course, the Saudi flag has a sword on it. Mm-hmm. So is this something you're dealing with in your book, this kind of Islam as a conquering religion, unlike especially Christianity, just in some way even Shiite, as being different from Muslim Islam?
Yeah, I mean it's certainly there, including the Sunni-Shiite contrast, which I think is quite real and quite important, in that... I mean, it's the the Sunni sort of cult of the Shiite cult of martyrdom that has made possible the kind of emotionality and political theater of Shiite Islamism, which the Sunni Islamists really haven't been able to match. I mean, it made for a very... And whether it matters, so to speak, for the character of the Islamic Republic now as opposed to the character of any given sort of Sunni setup, I don't know. But certainly for the character of the revolution, it surely does make a tremendous difference. The cult of martyrdom was something that, in the heritage, that could be mobilized in the Shiite case, and there just wasn't an equivalent in the Sunni case. Sorry?
Professor Cook knows me because he graciously served on my doctoral committee at SAIS, at Ken Davis Becker, a visiting fellow at Brookings. You said that the signature of Islam is a cultural memory of having a caliphate that includes the vivid rejection of despotism, corruption, and social values, including egalitarianism, and all of those things are, all those elements are part of the collection of concepts of what makes modern democracy, even though there's not a single fixed definition. Elements of social justice figure into it. So I wonder, would you say that when Salafis in Egypt, for example, talk about the democratic principles in Islam and use them to support their political goals, which we could say are democratic, depending on which splinter party, where they're coming from, are they being apologetic? take it from the other side of the argument. Is democracy fundamentally not just a political concept, but a spiritual concept as well?
Okay, now whether democracy is a spiritual concept, I'm not sure I'm going to have anything to say about that. But the question, are they being apologetic? I think it depends who they're talking to. I mean, you can say early Islam was true democracy with an apologetic intent to the West. You say to the West, yes, with an apologetic extent, intent. You know, we had it too, we're as good as you. But I mean, you can also say it in an internal context where what you're saying is, you know, we really ought to have a functioning democracy here because that's the proper Islamic way to do things. So I think, I mean, it's contextual whether it's apologetic or not. You know, it serves two obvious and distinct purposes. The question, of course, is how far you want to go in pushing the democratic character of the early polity. And I mean, I would say that, I mean, it's when, for example, Maududi talks about how they used to vote. I mean, that is really, I mean, for anyone who's actually read the sources, that is so implausible that it doesn't hold water. And there are probably too many people around who know that for that to be a very effective argument. So, I mean, the sort of characterizing the early caliphate as full-scale democracy, I'd have thought is, you know, simply in terms of, I mean, it's a very uphill argument as an argument. But on the other hand, yes, I mean, those kind of proto-republican values, you can, in very good faith, and probably effectively appeal to them.
In the back, sir.
Hi, Professor Cook. One of the things that I wondered about with respect to Salafism in particular, right, which is really, I suppose, the clearest case of your fundamentalist strain in Islam, and obviously it's a long strain with a long history. But it seems to me that part of the power of it in the modern era comes from the fact, and I think you might have touched on this in your comments, but I'd like you to flesh this out and maybe correct me if I misunderstood, but one of the things that strikes me is that Salafism offers you an Islamic sort of an authentic, if you will, I mean, problematic though that is, way of being modern in the modern era, even though it's hearkening back to this incredibly pre-modern time by saying we get to cut out all of the, you know, the sort of scholastic medieval tradition, but also all of the things that the reformists of the 19th century were calling for, you know, getting rid of superstition, Sufism, all of the accretions, et cetera. And the reason that this strikes me, it seems to me like, why is it that folks now who are educated, you know, these aren't people generally, or, you know, in many cases who are approaching out of ignorance, right? These are, in many cases, educated people who come out of a modern educated system of education, that the appeal of that kind of Salafism in the Islamic world is precisely it's an Islamic modernity in a funny way. And I don't know if this makes any sense, but it's like one of these things that strikes me, like, because you can be like, what is the modern heritage of Europe coming out of the sort of that Protestant Reformation, the rejection of the tradition, the, you know, each person can speak to God, understand the Bible, etc. And the Quran, of course, that's old in Islam, but Salafism really harkens back to that, right? It really gives you a way to be, you know, go to the text. The text then, it's a much more rational, if you will, once you accept the structure, it's a much more sort of rational and rationalizing approach to Islam. And I wonder if that makes it more appealing then to modern folks, and that it's not so much that it's an inherent thing. I buy your basic argument, it's an old thing, but why is it so widespread in the modern era? It seems to me not because of that, but because of its appeal to people who want to be modern and Muslim.
Right. I mean, I think in a way, the way you've presented the question also answers it, in that, if you want to have a religious movement in the modern world that is going to be really successful,
Well, of course, it helps to have Saudi oil money backing you. But I mean, I think it's very foolish to think that the appeal of Salafism is just that. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that. If you want to have a successful religious movement in the modern world, it has got to somehow be a way that you can be modern. Otherwise, it's just, you won't achieve takeoff. And I think, the kind of features that you point out in Salafism, the fact that we don't do any of this silly Sufi stuff, so to speak, this silly superstitious stuff. This is a sort of austere and, in a sense, rational, yeah? even though that's a very odd kind of thing to be coming out of the Hanbali tradition, which was, in theological terms, very anti-rational. And what we're talking about is unlikely affinities that you have between things sort of that existed long before the modern world and things that exist now. And these affinities may in some ways be quite fortuitous, but if they're there, they can work for you. Now, of course, I mean, not all Salafis are like this. I mean, there are conservatives in Saudi Arabia who live without telephones, without cars, etc. But I mean, that is clearly a very marginal phenomenon compared to the kind of Salafis that you were talking about.
Hi. My question is, thank you for all your remarks. My question is around, given the current state of on identity politics, looking at Egypt today, and Turkey in particular, I'd like to focus on those two countries. You have in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood out and the military back in. You have Muslims who reject Muslim Brotherhood and this kind of overarching theological theology, I suppose. And then in Turkey, you have the opposite. And those two peoples now are at odds, whichever way this goes, as long as it matches, it's kind of a mix and match. Is there a kind, and those two countries being very prominent countries in the region, or at least Egypt for the Arab world, do you see any sort of major shift that's going to happen, depending on how things go today, in terms of identity politics in the region? Like, is there now a potential for a real break from, this supranational Muslim state and more towards, back to nationalism kind of? Like, is there something that's unique about the what's happening today, the dynamics of identity politics today, that can have an impact on to kind of what direction, philosophically the regions go? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, but I'm not sure that I have a good answer to it. I mean, my expectation would be that a sense of wider Muslim identity and a certain politicization of that is going to be with us for a long time, but that also nations in the Middle East, the ones that are more like nations, and say Egypt, Turkey, Iran are the ones that are most convincing as nations in the Middle East. They're going to be with us too. And how that's going to play out, I would leave to a true prophet to say.
Garrett, did you have a question? I skipped you over you before, I forgot. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And Garrett, this will be our last question, and we'll let everyone go home on time like we promised, but will you have a few minutes to stay around afterwards?
Yeah.
So for those of you that I didn't call on, perhaps we can continue the conversation after we let everybody leave who wants to go.
Professor Cook, I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to ask you a very different kind of question. That is, I've been sitting here thinking about how you've talked about your book and the responses to the questions that you've given, and I was wondering, was this a book that's always been in your head, and along came this award that allowed you to spend some time and get it down on paper? Or was this more of an opportunity or an occasion to say, this is subject matter I've been thinking about for some time, but I want to I want to get it down on paper and see where this takes me. And if it's the latter, if it was more exploratory in nature rather than sort of, you know, writing your music down, what was there something in this process that surprised you as you thought about it and wrote about it? And if that's the case, what was it?
Right. I think it was certainly the second and not the first. I was not born with this book in my head, nor did I have it. I have anything like it in my head at the age of 20 or 30 or 40, etc. It's something that, I mean, I don't think that I'd even begun to have the first glimmerings of a thought about it at the time when we decided to put that course on. It came, you know, when I had to do, obviously it must have occurred to me to suggest that we have a comparative lecture. So there must have been something in my head that, sort of favored some kind of comparison. But I don't think there was any sort of content to it at that point. So I mean, this is something that, you know, that emerged. And then, so what was the second part of the question?
In the process.
What surprised me,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, I think I had kind of bought into the picture that you get from, how can I put it, Tim? And say if you read the review section of the New York Times, every now and again there's a book saying, God is back. Secularists, beware, despair. And I think I had kind of bought into that. And what this comparative exercise did for me was to make me realize that it isn't actually like that, that there are very large parts of the world where God is not conspicuously back, or if he is, he's not playing a conspicuous political role. And that just as Western Europe is an outlier, so also the Islamic world is an outlier. I think that would probably be the single thing that surprised me most. Suggested I read rather uncritically before that.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking Professor Cook. This was really wonderful. We appreciate it.